Good afternoon, and welcome to UTalk here on 101.5 FM on UMFM. We connect with amazing people from across Canada and ask them about their stories, passions, and experiences. I'm your host, Ryan Funk. Today we'll be hearing from the amazingly talented Don Amaro. After he and I talk, we'll hear from Lisa Muswagen and Isabel Scribe as they teach us about Cree from U Multicultural's Indigenous Languages series. Let's get into it. Don Amaro is a storyteller, singer-songwriter and performer, and a three-time Juno Award nominee. As an individual of Cree and Métis heritage, Don has been recognized for his advocacy work within Indigenous communities and beyond. Don and I talked about music, community, and the role of public figures in discussions on important topics.
Yeah, well, so yeah, name's Don Amaro. Born and raised right here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Been here my whole life. I spent a little bit of time in Nova Scotia as a kid. My dad's from out that way. But for the most part, Winnipeg's always been home. My family and I now, I got three kids, age 9, 5, and 2. We reside in Transcona, the metropolis of Transcona here in Winnipeg. And I'm a full-time musician. I started doing music about 14 years ago full-time. And 13, 14 years ago. And it's crazy to me when I say that, to think that I've been, it's, you know, been over a decade of doing this. To say I've loved every minute of it would be a lie. But I think for sure it's been a journey that I really enjoyed being on. You know, there's no other road that I think would have been as much of an enjoyable roller coaster ride as this one has been. And I've been lucky enough to, you know, create a community of support around me that has enabled me to really thrive in this industry, even through a pandemic. It's strange to say this, but 2020 was probably my best year, which is strange because I wasn't out playing gigs. So I definitely count my blessings awesome. There.
And yeah, you mentioned 9, 5, and 2 for your kids. So those are pretty crazy ages as they're getting up there.
Yeah, it's a roller coaster ride there too. My oldest is, he tests us. You know, I was talking to my mom yesterday, and I was just saying how, you know, he's our guinea pig. We're figuring out how to be parents with this kid, and the other two benefit from all the lessons we're learning with him. Because, I mean, we're trying things out, kind of going, is this the right way to parent? And I was a bit of a helicopter dad, you know, with him when he was a little baby. And, you know, we're seeing the ramifications of that. And then also, like, so now my third one, he's two, my little guy, Elliot, he's this free range kid that's just like, we're like, yeah, he's over there. He's good. He's all right. And where we just really learn so many lessons with our first kid. So, and my daughter, who's six, I said five, but she just turned six this week. And she's the middle kid. So she's kind of like in the middle of this, like, older kid figuring stuff out. Little kid who you're super intensely involved with, and then she's just like this like little butterfly floating around the house who's just like pleasant to be around all the time, and you know, but also like I think demands attention once in a while, which rightly so. I was a middle kid, I know what that's like. It's a real a juggle with obviously career and family stuff, always trying to figure that out. And but I'm lucky to say that my wife's a stay-at-home mother. And she works incredibly hard with those three little.
You mentioned a helicopter parent. I think that's every parent's first kid. They're always so focused on like, oh, we got to get this right. We're gonna make a mistake. Because yeah, that was the same with my parents. I'm the eldest, and you can definitely see how the freedoms change with each kid going down. But oh, that's super cool.
Totally,
That's awesome. Having a career and a family at the same time, both very fulfilling.
I was going to say, you know, like for first time parents, I remember the feeling of like the very first time they said, okay, you're free to go. And I'm like, I have to take this thing home and like keep it alive. Like, you know, and I think every parent goes through like this phase of like, oh man, I hope I do this right. And the whole time you're just kind of like eyeballs on the kid, making sure that they're surviving and breathing and living. It's just like, it's really strange. And then, by the third kid, you're like, what's your name again?
So you mentioned about 15 years you've been in the music industry. So what first inspired you to pursue music?
Yeah, I mean, it was my parents, I often share this. My parents were great singers and songwriters. My dad, again, from the East Coast, he's, you know, East Coast Acadian European descent. my mom from here in Manitoba, so Cree and Métis background for her. And they met here, and my dad brought that East Coast kitchen party, thing here. And every payday would be like a case of beer and friends around and singing songs. And it was really a beautiful thing because it was like, as I look around now, that's really something we don't see as often is like sort of just people getting together around music for the sake of it wasn't a show. Nobody was getting paid. It was just for the love of music. And so that their passion for music really fell into my, my life. And I just watched them sing and play. They really wanted to be musicians. I think they really wanted to go out and do something with it. But they had us super young. My older brother came around. My mom was, I think, 18, 19 years old. And then I, about a year and a half after that, and just obviously that changes priorities, and you have to make sure you have a stable income, and Lord knows musicians don't always have a stable income. And so that was my first love of music. My dad played all kinds of records too, like Lionel Richie, Elton John, CCR, Alabama, all these John Denver, all these classic
Oh yeah, the classics,
songwriters
yeah.
that are just like. In this, even in our day and age now, where it's like those are the iconic songwriters of our history, and I just felt like I was really fed this great music through a lot of my young life, and then when I was 15, so I'd never really dabbled with it until I was about 15. I'd always been like the shops and mechanics and woodworking kid, and then obviously it was a girl who I liked, and she was in the arts, and I was like, I should go over there because at least then she might notice me over there. I got up and I auditioned for the junior high school play, Oklahoma. Didn't know whether I could sing or not. My mom was always like, "Oh, you're such a good singer. You'll be fine." But moms are supposed to say that even if you suck, I think. And so then I got up. I did the audition. My teacher was in tears. A couple of the girls were in tears. And I was like, "Oh man, what happened? I making them cry. I'm so bad at making them cry." And it was a good moment because I got the lead role of the play that year. And literally, probably about a year after that, I picked up my dad's old Gibson Hummingbird guitar, started playing a couple of chords, like learning, E minor was my first one because it's the easiest, I think. And just kind of followed that trail for the next 10, 15 years of like just I was a closet singer-songwriter for a long time. I didn't really share any of that stuff with anybody for probably until I was in my 20s. But yeah, that's kind of where it started.
Yeah, it's always something that just is the catalyst that kind of starts it all off for you was that Oklahoma play. Just you're like, all right, let's do it, let's try it, and then yeah, it just starts to bubble up towards bigger things. You were also a contestant or tried out for Canadian Idol, correct?
Yeah, that was really interesting because I've seen American Idol a couple of times. I thought, oh, that's pretty cool, pretty epic, experience. And I was driving around downtown Winnipeg, and I came on the radio on a Sunday afternoon. They said, "Okay, Canadian Idol audition is still happening right now at Portage Place Mall. You've got 30 minutes left if you would like to audition." I was literally a block away from the mall, and I was like, "I'm right here. I'll go try it out." And I said to myself, "If there's a lineup, I'll just walk away because I don't got that kind of time." And I walk in, and there's nobody there. I literally walked up to the desk. I was like, "I'd like to audition." And they're like, "Oh yeah, sure. Here's your number." And I go through, and I sing a couple of songs for some people, and then I go sing in another room for some other people. So I guess they really got to vet to see if you like. Should go and sing for the actual judges. So they said, "Yeah, here, come back tomorrow and sing for the celebrity judges," which was Zach Warner, Jake Gold, Sass Jordan, and Farley Flex. And so I went and auditioned for these people, and I got the golden ticket to go to Toronto, and then I got in Toronto. I made it all the way up to the final, basically just before the top 22. So I was there the last day. So it start. I think it started like. The number was like 15,000 people across Canada auditioned. I was in the top 100 by the sort of the very end, and then they sent me home. And it was a pretty brutal blow because I remember sitting there going, "Everybody here's pretty good." By the time you get to that point, everybody's a pretty good singer. But I remember going, "I think I'm better than that person. I think I could sing better than them." And kind of like I'm assessing this, and then they sent me home. Only for me to realize, not too far after that was. Really, what they're trying to do in this show is it's a production, and it's all very produced, and they're looking for characters. I really wanted to sing really good, but I wasn't thinking about what's my character that I'm bringing to this TV show. And I think if in hindsight, if I can go back and do that again, I'd try to bring more of who Donna Merrow is out. But I learned a lot through that process, and most importantly, to believe in myself, you know. And so that was the gift through that whole process.
Yeah, even if you don't get in, the story that comes out of that is just, it's awesome. And like you mentioned, the personalities, yeah, like when they're vetting people, you know, there's the people who are really, really good at performing. And then, you know, there's those very interesting character pieces that they're like, oh yeah, I can sing. Yeah. And my thought process is always in the behind the scenes. It's like, do these people actually think they can sing, or that they're performance is great, or they're in on the joke and they're like, oh, here's a crazy thing?
Yeah, I don't know, like some, like those, like the William Hungs, do you remember that story from 20 years ago, or like American Idol?
Maybe I'd have to look,
he was pretty bad, but he became an internet sensation, and I think his career blew up. I think he probably started releasing albums and stuff, and like, you know, he's had a better career than I could probably even ever dream of, but he was pretty bad. And there are artists that have come out and have done this thing that get on the show and you're like, what are you doing on here? You know, this is a singing contest and clearly you can't sing. I really don't know if it's them just have no idea and they're tone deaf and go, I think I could sing, but I don't know. I mean, I like to think that I'm good at assessing that, but I'm not sure what people are thinking.
Yeah, kind of in the internet era, things are a little unpredictable. You never know what's gonna blow up online.
I read yesterday that right now the highest paid YouTuber is a 9-year-old kid who reviews toys.
Mm-hmm.
He gets paid something like $20 million.
I can't remember the name, but I know who you're talking about.
Ryan something.
Yeah, Ryan does toys or something like that.
Yeah. Isn't that madness?
It's crazy. I guess it's just all the kids watching YouTube videos and then just pressing that repeat button over and over again, so the algorithm loves it.
Here's what led me down the trail to find out who's getting the most money on YouTube. My son, my little guy, 2-year-old, he loves tractors and diggers and all those kinds of things, right? Obviously, like every, you know, little boy usually does. And we stumbled upon this show called Blippi. And Blippi's like this character, like this guy who basically explains diggers to kids and tractors and bulldozers and explains all the parts and stuff. It's really simple. And I was like, but I glanced at one of his, like, how many views he had on this video. There's 30 million views on this one video. And he's got hundreds of these videos. And I'm thinking, holy smokes, what does this guy make? He's in the top 20 of YouTube paid stars. And I'm like, I think it was like $60 million he made last year or something. I'm like, holy smokes. I got to do something else, maybe. I got to become the next Blippi or something. I don't know. But it was just, I couldn't believe it. I was like, man, this, like you say, the things you would least suspect to be massive successes can tend to do that.
Twitch streamers, TikTok stars, YouTubers, when they do those video tours, you're like, whoa, wait, you're making this kind of money. It's like just this thing out of a surreal painting. It's no furniture, just white walls. You're like, where are you living? A museum? What is this? What kind of money are you making?
Yeah, like, and I sometimes think, like, I overthink things sometimes, and I think sometimes the simplicity of it all could sort of be the thing that works. And I also think, like, you can't really calculate, like, if I do this, this will work. It's kind of like you got to try stuff, and then hopefully it connects, and if not, try something else. Like, as an artist, I've learned to really try to adapt and change and evolve and constantly be thinking that way. Because, I mean, music's one thing that I do, but I also do a lot of, like, speaking engagements. I do a lot of, opportunities. I'm actually starting a podcast of my own because Lord knows there's not enough podcasts out there. So I feel this call to kind of get into podcast games. So that's something else I'm doing. So I'm always willing to try things out, and I feel like if I've got an idea that I'm really passionate about, I should chase that. And if the door slams in my face, I'm okay with that. I'm just not okay with not giving it a shot, you know?
Yeah, of course. And at the end of the day, doing a podcast, even if it doesn't get any views or people coming in to get sponsorships, it's fun just to sit down and get your thoughts out there. It's almost like a new version of journaling.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a good way to think about it, actually. I'm gonna use that. I'm going to steal that. Let's journal together.
No worries. Just helping out. So we mentioned a little bit about we never know when things are going to blow up. And in terms of artists or musicians, you know, it takes talent, but it also takes luck.
Well, I mean, so I didn't realize this early on. I mean, a number of things. First of all, when I first started, I said, okay, any successful business has to have a vision or a mission statement. And I don't think a lot of artists think that way. I think a lot of artists go, I want to create a good song and hopefully people like it. And that's one piece of it. But then I started thinking, okay, but what is really my intention? What is my hope behind all of this? And it was like, okay, I got to create a vision for this and my mission statement. And it was and still is to this day, is to write music and share it in hopes that it would encourage and inspire the listener to do great things for themselves and the world around them. And so it's always like this idea of like, whatever I put out there, it's medicine for me first. And I hope it's medicine for you as a listener that then you could take and apply it to your life and it makes your day better, you know? That's always been my hope. And then literally, I don't know, I'd say about 3 or 4 years ago, I started thinking, wait a second, I'm a musician. I work in the entertainment world. But I started thinking more about like what I do is I'm a server. I'm in it with an attitude of service. So I've been starting to say I'm in the service industry, which just kind of throws people off, right? But I realized what I'm trying to do is serve people with stuff that will help their lives in the daily, you know? Even when if you go through my Twitter account and my social media stuff, I think you'll find that thread of like, there's always like this, like, piece of encouragement that I hope people take away with. Even when things are hard and struggling, like I want people to kind of find something that will give them encouragement, you know, and that's something that I'm always drawn to those kinds of accounts too. Like there's one guy, Prince EA is his name. And he's always inspiring. Jay Shetty, you know, he's a great, you know, one of the world's top podcasters, you know, for mind and health. I gravitate towards that. So my hope is that what I do would serve the listener, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that's probably a much healthier mindset to be in than getting kind of surrounded by the fame or success. And it can kind of, you can spiral out of control, as we've seen from some successful people on YouTube or TikTok, and it kind of gets their head. But yeah, you're right, that service aspect, it's not just entertainment, you're wanting to bring value to someone that you can help them out in any small means. Maybe they're having a hard day and they just need someone to listen to, a voice to hear in their head as they're driving to work or working on a project.
Well, and here's the thing. So I realized a long time ago too that if my goal was win a Grammy, you know, awards shows, whatever, a number one single on radio, if that was my goal, I thought, okay, but then what, right? Like if that becomes the mountaintop, you get there and you go, okay, what now, right? And then I started thinking, okay, so that's not really what I want to do. I'm not in this for those things. I'm not in this for fame. I'm not in this for fortune. I've always thought of it as this. If my goal is to serve people and help them in their daily life, a byproduct of that might be awards. A byproduct of that might be financial success. A byproduct of that might be fans, you know? And I just realized that all those things are, that's not my driving force, you know? I mentioned a while ago about sort of a community of people that surround me and hold me up to do what I love. I really see that as my the biggest strength is people that believe in my vision, believe in what I'm doing, and really, they're my foundation, you know? And so no matter what goes on, I might have, my next single might go number one, might create this big, huge whatever, but then what, right? Then the floor could fall out, and then that part of your career is done. But if your foundation is a solid foundation of people who really believe in you, you're not going to fall very far. They're going to catch you, and they're going to be there right there with you. Like the idea of being a top selling artist for the rest of your life, like the Elton Johns of the world I mentioned, right? Like he can still, all his life he's been able to sell out arenas, right? That's not everybody's story. And you know, right now I'm comfortable in a, you know, 300 seat venue, and I can have these intimate sort of sessions with people. I don't know if an arena tour will ever be part of my story, but I'm happy doing what I'm doing right now. And if arena tour happens, that'd be cool. But I think it'll always come back to that foundation of people that I really want to connect with in that community I keep speaking of.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, building a community as a public figure, do you feel it's important to discuss complex and social topics, you know, things that come up every day, like in terms of the 215 that happened recently in Canadian news? Do you feel it's important as a public figure to talk about that?
I think that's another important thing, yes, because I feel like that's part of the service, right? It's part of like, all I can do is share my thoughts and share my ideas, and not all of them are going to resonate with everybody, and not all of them are going to, not everybody's going to agree with what I have to share. But I do think that we have a responsibility when we have a platform, and you know, mine's not massive. I've got, you know, a couple thousand people that pay attention to what I'm doing, but I feel like I get to be a leader in that, in this community, and I can, and if I'm engaged in this conversation, then I think that inspires other people to be engaged in that conversation too. And so, you know, you mentioned the 215, that part of that conversation is reconciliation. And I think if I bring it up, I think then the average person goes, oh yeah, I should probably be thinking about this stuff too. And I just see it as an opportunity to really educate myself and in turn share with others what I'm learning, you know? And I think that that's pretty important. And so I remember when this 215, you know, these 215 children were found in Kamloops, I mentioned to the Canadian Country Music Association that I think we really need to be on the front lines as artists. And I was really disappointed at the lack of response from a lot of the country community. And then we started to see more engagement there as well. And I just think people really need to take charge of the information we have and be able to at least speak to it. And hopefully, again, I think that's part of reconciliation, is that we all are engaged in this conversation, and we don't have to have it all figured out. I just think we have to kind of put ourselves in the story and be part of the building something new for our future.
Mm-hmm. And on the topic of reconciliation, you had a conversation with some friends, Steve Bell, Seraph Eden, and Tyler Joe Miller, about reconciliation. Why did you want to have that chat? And what kind of things did you discuss there?
Well, so we did one a little bit earlier with, it was my friend Alan Gray Eyes, Sarah Burke, and now I'm forgetting somebody. We did one earlier, and it went really well. And my intention was, I wanted it to be a conversation that was open-hearted and kind of like the feeling of four friends sitting down in a pub or a cafe and having this open-hearted conversation about what is reconciliation, what does that mean to you? Do you have any questions for me? Do I have any questions for you? And being able to do that in a friendly way where we can laugh together, we could you know, just kind of connect in that way. And I think a lot of people are often wondering, well, how am I supposed to engage in this conversation? How am I supposed to? What do I do? What does this look like? And so I wanted us to be sort of like an hour's worth of living, breathing reconciliation conversation, and between some Indigenous people and some non-Indigenous peoples, and really just be an example of that conversation. And so that was my whole intention with that. We may do some more down the road, but I think that was the heart of that, was really just sort of like having an opportunity to share some thoughts and what we're wrestling with right now. And really just how can we build towards something together?
Yeah, I think that's a great approach, that just friendly conversation with, you know, people you're close to and you feel that you can open up to. I think in terms of making the biggest changes in life in terms of social development or social issues or equality and diversity are conversations at home. If you can have those debates, conversations with your family, and, you know, change their mind for the better, if they are on an opposite side, you know, they'll talk to someone else and start sharing those ideas. And then it's a domino effect going down. Or at least that's what I've seen online people say. If you start at home, it can slowly, you know, grow throughout your community.
Well, I've been saying this, like reconciliation is not an action to be done by government or by corporate policies. That's not where it's going to happen. It's really going to happen, like you say, in the home. It's changing the individual psyche to recognize that we all have a place in this story. And I think until we all get to that place of like, oh yeah, I am part of this. If you're here in this country and your feet are on the ground, you're part of this, whether you like it or not. And I think that a lot of people want to just shrug off that responsibility. And I've been saying this too, is that you have an opportunity to be educated and learn more about the story and figure out what your place in this is. Or there's only two other options I can see, is you become ignorant or you're complicit in the story. And something I shared recently, forgive me, I'm on my soapbox here for a minute. But I shared recently is that like I know a lot of people heard about the 215, and now obviously there's more and more numbers coming out all the time, and there's more and more discoveries of these grave sites. And I said, you can be heartbroken. Like, there's so many people out there that are heartbroken by this. And I said, but you can still continue to be complicit in this. Oh, you can be heartbroken at the hate and racism of our history, but continue to be complicit in the systems that are built on that same racism and hate. And I think that that's a hard one to wrap our heads around. It's like, oh yeah, we can be heartbroken and cry and sit in the corner and weep, but then not really change anything about our own personal lives. And I wrestle with this too, because I'm thinking, okay, so where, even as a person who identifies as an Indigenous, I grew up in the city. I grew up predominantly kind of thinking I was not Indigenous, and wondering what systems and things do I partake in that is part of that racism and hate, you know? And so I think about that for myself. And I think if you're not even doing that, that's a big first step, is kind of just really kind of assessing your life and going, what am I part of that has been part of that hate and racism? You know, it's a big question to ask yourself.
Yeah. And even if you're struggling in like a city setting, like you're having trouble paying your bills, you never know when you're going to be able to pay for rent, it's still a different experience out on reserves that people are going through. And I think for myself, I'm constantly wanting to learn more, engage with people, learn about their stories. Because at the end, I would like to see a government system where we're all cared for equally. That's my dream. There's always those conversations of like, oh, why do we have to give everyone handouts? It's like, well, if we're in a system where everyone is treated equally and has equal opportunities, you know, there wouldn't be a need for handouts. Everyone has those, you know, stability, that foundation that you were like mentioning before.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because you talk to kids about this stuff, and kids can kind of click into it right away and kind of go, wait a second, yeah. Like I asked my children a little while ago, I don't know if you saw this, but I posted this on Twitter, and I said, hey guys, like Canada, and I don't want to take Canada Day away from my kids, and I'm a person who is proud of the good things of this country. I think it does feel a bit upside down. In terms of when you look at this whole story. But I don't want my kids to feel this shame of who they are in this whole story, right? I want them to kind of feel like they wanted to you know, paint a flag and do the thing. And I don't want to rob that of them. But I did want them to understand a piece of the story, as much as their, you know, young minds can understand. Here's our foundation. Understand this. And you know, like, so when my little girl would say, you know, Canada is the best, I ask her, so why do you think Canada is the best? And then she gets we have this little friend, like you said, have these conversations at home, have a friendly little dialogue. And I don't want to like rip the rug from under her feet and say, no, it's all hate and racism and murder and, you know, and this and that. And I wouldn't do that with my kids, but I'd have them I'd like to them to ask the question, why do you think we're a great country? And then the other thing was, I said, you know, for Canada Day, we're going to kind of just lay low and stand. We visited some friends, but we didn't have a big Canada Day, you know, flags out and fireworks and stuff ourselves. And I said, because here's the thing, you know, one of the things we are struggling with is that we as a country spend hundreds of millions of dollars, I'm sure, every year on Canada Day celebrations. Meanwhile, we've got all these communities without proper drinking water, and some of them 20-year water boil advisories. And yet we still find a way to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on these celebrations. And I said, what would you guys prefer? Would you guys prefer we spend all that money on this fireworks? Or would you rather we spend money to make sure kids in other communities have clean drinking water? And they immediately said, clean drinking water, of course. And there are adults that go, you can't take away fireworks. But yet my kids go, oh yeah, of course. We want to, how we love each other is through the basic human rights, you know? And I think that that's one of the things that I love about young minds is they get it right away. And as we get older, it's convoluted and we have all this stuff, this baggage that we grew up with and we take with us. And yet you ask a young person, they seem to get it right away. And so I love having those kinds of conversations at home.
Yeah, the younger generations, they just get it. They're on it. Like in terms of like Gen Z and the next generation coming in, they're so open to diversity, different multiculturalism, LGBTQ rights and acceptance. Yeah, they're just on it. And in terms of conversations I have with people of older generations, I understand, you know, you've lived in that mindset for so long. So, of course, it's going to be hard to open up to that. So I guess, yeah, it's important not to get frustrated at them, but continually work together.
Yeah, it's a tearing down of their own personal walls in their mind, right? Like, you believed in this one thing so long. Like, you know, like if I told you the earth was absolutely flat, you know, and here's the evidence, it would be hard for you to like kind of go, wait a second, I've been told my whole life it's this, right? And I think that's such a hard thing. Here I am bringing up flat earth now. I think that's, you know, as you get older, you believe so much in your ways. I've always felt like I want to be moldable and shapeable and be willing to kind of move, not compromise who I am or my beliefs, but like be willing to evolve always and not ever kind of, I never want to be a staunchy old stuck in my way kind of guy. You know, I always hope that, you know, what I can be even into my later years that I'm always just willing to kind of like move and learn and educate myself. I think that's the big key in this whole thing is educating ourselves, right? If we're not willing to budge in terms of even just learning, basic learning, then that's where we get stuck. And people sometimes just want to continue to be ignorant. And that's an unfortunate thing. And you can't force people to not be. That's really up to them to sort of take the reins of that in their own life.
I think for myself, one of the greatest moments of growth that I've had in the recent years is accepting when I'm wrong about things. Mm. And it's okay to be wrong. Like, I used to, you know, die on a hill for something. It's like, oh,
yeah,
I'm right about this. You can't change my mind. But now just being open, be like, I get things wrong all the time. I'm not that old. My memory just isn't as good as it used to be. But yeah, when someone gives me information or evidence and they're like, hey, this is actually the thing. It's like, oh, wait, you're right.
Right.
You're right.
You don't have kids, right?
No.
See, that's what I say. I've got three kids. I am wrong every single day and they remind me. So kids change you, man. It's one of those things that I was like, you know, I realize that I almost think that, you know, as much as I, you know, as a parent, you're often like, I'm going to teach them this. I'm going to give them this and blah, blah, blah. I really think it's such an equal balance of like the things you learn from them and the thing they teach you. It's like, it's really, really on level ground. And so, and they do not mince words. My 9-year-old is quick to correct me when I'm in the wrong. And sometimes he's wrong, but oftentimes he's right.
Yeah, and it's never bad to have those kind of checks in your life.
It's hard pill to swallow, but yeah, we really want our kids to have their own voices, and so it means for tough years because then they in the home they think it's a democracy, and really, you know, we're like, well, we make the rules, but we also understand why you want to battle us. We want you to grow up and question authority. We want you to grow up and if you have a problem with something, question it, you know, and sometimes it means like I'm making dinner, my 2-year-old's crying at my ankles, Stella's flying off the handle somewhere else, and my 9-year-old is challenging me on his bedtime, right? And it's just like, well, no, because it's bedtime, because we say it's bedtime, and that's it. And yet he can't fully fathom that. But it's just like, but I'm proud of him for questioning and wanting to get to the root of like, why are you putting me to bed at 8:30? You know, I'm 9 years old. I should go to bed at 9. It's like, you know, and I applaud that. Now, I didn't last night, but I applaud it now.
Mm-hmm. Of course, yeah. Since I don't have kids, I really don't have that sort of experience yet. But that's very interesting. You're incredibly involved in a lot of things. You know, when you're having these conversations with your friends, your music, having, you know, building that audience. Another thing you're involved in is this Project 11 Check-In podcast. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about that and how you got involved in all that?
Kind of an interesting story. I met Mr. Mark Chipman of the Winnipeg Jets a couple of years ago, and then he invited me to sing at, I'm trying to think what it was now. Now it's kind of gray in my mind now, It led us to sitting down and having a dinner. Actually, we sat down and he just kind of picked my brain of what I was up to, and it led me to singing an anthem. That's what it. I got to sing an anthem a couple years ago, for the Wasack night at the Winnipeg Jets. And Winnipeg Jets, by the way, have done a tremendous job of enacting their calls to action in terms of the 94 calls to action from the Reconciliation Commission. And so we've just kind of been really great friends ever since. We talk weekly, me and Mark, and so a couple of years ago, they just before the pandemic hit, or just as the pandemic hit, we were like, well, we wanted to get Dawn involved, Project 11, which is part of True North Youth Foundation, and they're kind of a youth mental health awareness sort of education tool that it's in schools all across Manitoba. And so they wanted me to come out and play some songs and share some stories in schools. Well, pandemic hit, and we're like, okay, so what's our pivot plan, right? And we talked about a podcast, and we thought, okay, let's go that way. And basically, it's just us having conversations with, you know, some of the Winnipeg Jets teammates, some of the Winnipeg Jets staff, some doctors, some important influential people here in Manitoba who we feel like just have really important things to say, and we just have these conversations about their lives, how they got to be doing what they're doing, and it's all surrounding mental health and kind of giving people some extra tools to help them on the daily. And it's just been a really great learning thing for me for podcasts. So if I'm going to start my own this fall, which I'm hoping to, I think that was a really good learning thing. And so we're planning a bunch more obviously coming up, and going to keep it rolling. It's called Through the Fire. So I think our plan is to record some stuff soon. And then probably in 2022, we'll be able to kind of get a release plan going for that. So stay tuned.
Yeah, this podcast, if it comes to fruition, sounds like it's going to be great. You've had all these experiences through your conversations with friends through this Project 11. You're going to really develop those skills for something awesome.
I'm looking forward to making tens and tens of dollars off my podcast.
the dream. It's the real dream right there. Yes, well, thank you so much for your time. And I don't want to eat up any more of your day. So just finally, what advice would you give people looking to pick up music or make a career of it?
Yeah, you know, I'll say it again, you know, just because I think I can only share what worked for me. And, you know, the one thing that I think is important is you know, look to, you know, other artists that inspire you. But understand that your story will not be similar to theirs. You know, like it's one thing to kind of be inspired by somebody else. It's another thing to kind of just hope that your career is exactly the same as theirs. I don't think that any two careers are exactly identical. I think every career is very different. So, you know, find some artists that you're inspired by and glean, you know, what you can from them, because I think that's going to give you some strength for what it is that you do. And the other thing is really understand what it is that you want to do, because you know, it's important to know what you want to do, but know why you want to do it. And that's getting back to the whole, you know, me being in the service industry and helping people with music as medicine kind of idea. I think if you know the why, I think whenever you get lost on the road, you can kind of go, wait a second, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, right? Because it's going to happen. Like throughout my career, I've been like, you know, there's things that detract you. It's like that shiny thing over there is like, oh, I'm going to go follow that thing for a bit. And then you go, wait a second, I've gone off track here. And if you know your why, that's sort of like the ground zero. You can always come back to that. And I think it's okay to like divert and kind of try different things along the way. Like I remember a couple of years ago, I did the Huron Carol with Tom Jackson. And Tom Jackson is a legendary actor, musician here in Canada, and he said to me, don't wear just one hat in the music industry. In the industry, wear multiple hats as an entertainer, because you know, you want to be multifaceted, because if I lost my voice or lost my hand or something, then that piece kind of goes with it. And that's not to say you still can't find ways to make it work for you in music, but I think I'm getting more known as a speaker. I'm getting more known as somebody who has some important things to say that people sort of, you know, it resonates with them, which is great. I love acting. I don't do a lot of it, but I've done some of that. And I love working with young people and helping sort of, I can be part of molding their minds and thinking in the right way and opening up something for them. That's kind of what I like to do. And I just think diversity is key. And so that's what I mean by like, be willing to try things. So if there is a shiny thing over there that you want to kind of go chase that thing, that's okay. But if it starts to feel like, wait a second, I've gone off track, you know your why, and it's easy to come back to that. So that's the long story of sort of hopefully something that I can give advice to the next generation of musicians coming up.
Lisa Muswagon is a member of the Pimichikamak Cree Nation, also known as Cross Lake in northern Manitoba. Lisa is an Akwaita Cree. Lisa grew up in northern Manitoba, the Interlake, and Winnipeg. Her father attended the residential school at Guy Hill, and her mother attended day school at Cross Lake. An intergenerational survivor, Lisa also attended day school at Jack River School and experienced the residential school system's effects. She is on the path of breaking cycles such as learning to speak Cree to pass on to the children and grandchildren. Isabel Scribe is a member of the Pimichikamak Cree Nation, also known as Cross Lake in northern Manitoba. Her homeland is Pimichikamak, and she is a fluent speaker in the Swampy Cree language. Isabel and her husband Charles raise their kids in ceremonies and with traditions. She provides culturally responsive counseling, therapy, and Indigenous ceremonies and empowerment through storytelling, workshops, sharing circles, and much more.
Dance in Duthemik, in Duthemak. Hello, relatives. My name is Lisa Muswagon, and I am from the Pimichikamak Cree Nation, also known as Cross Lake, which is located in northern Manitoba. And I would like to introduce my mother, Isabel Scribe. She is a fluent speaker in our Swampy Cree language. And today we are here to teach you a couple of words in our language. The words that we want to teach you are basic greetings. So if I were to see you on the street and you see us on the street, we would like you to come and use these words. You can also use them in any other place that you go to gathering. If you want to speak some Cree and you want to say hello and whatever, well, we have the basic words for you here. Mom, when I started and introduced myself, did I say that correctly? I said Danse in Duthemak. That meant hello, relatives.
My name is Isabel Scribe. I'm a traditional elder in my community of Winnipeg and Cross Lake, Pimichikamak Cree Nation. I'm also a counselor. A therapist, psychotherapist. So here I'm here today to learn about the language, the Cree language, along with my daughter Lisa. And here today we're gonna talk about introducing ourselves. Like the first language we always greet our people is Tansi, my relatives, you know, my relations, you know. Everything on earth is a relation to the nature, you know, so you greet everybody and every individual on earth. So that's very important to greet everybody like that in our language, you know. So Tansi is a good word.
So the first word that we're going to say and we want you to say with us is Tansi. Mm-hmm. So when I count to three, say it with us. One, so I'm going to say Tansi. I'm going to say one, two, three. I'm going to say Danse, and then you're going to say it right after me. Okay? So one, two, three, Danse.
Danse.
There. Very Danse. Good. Mm-hmm. Danse. So hello. If I see my mom and I see her somewhere and I'm like, Danse. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's hello. That's the first word that we're going to learn. And so it's a very, very important greeting. Mm-hmm. I wanted to share a little bit about, I guess, the background of our language. the Cree language actually comes in different forms. There's Woodlands Cree, there's Swampy Cree, there's Plains Cree, but also too, there was a period in our time where the Indigenous people went through the residential school. And so during the residential school, it was said that you weren't allowed to speak your language. The government put in this process that wanted to assimilate us into the rest of Canada by not allowing us to speak our language. And so there were some people that still held on to our mother tongue, and they came out of the residential school with language. However, for example, my mother, she's a very fluent speaker. My father, he speaks Cree, but he also wanted us to learn English and felt that it was very important for us to learn English, that we wouldn't have the struggles that he faced when he was growing up. So he didn't want that for us. And that goes with a lot of probably people in my generation. And so a lot of us are taking the opportunity to break those cycles and to learn our language. So we're very fortunate to have someone in our family who speaks the language, because for somebody like me who wants to learn, I can understand my mother when she speaks, but for me, I don't have the tongue. So I'm in the process of learning with my mother. And so I thought it would be a great idea if we could all learn together with my mother. Yeah. So, like we said, danse was the first word that we wanted to learn. If I said to my mom, danse, she would reply,
monantau.
She said, monantau, which means,
I'm okay.
Or I'm fine. So I would say, mm-hmm, dance, and she would say,
monantau. Monantau.
So okay, let's try that together with my mother. One, two, three.
Monantau. Monantau.
Now we'll try.
Monantau.
Good job. Wow. Hey, so that was the second greeting that we're learning. And another one that we could learn is, now mind you, there are other ways to say how you feel and whatnot, but of course it's a little bit complicated, but right now we're learning the basics. So monantau is basic, and that's I'm fine and I am okay.
One of the precious languages in the Cree language is thank you. It's a very honorable word for everybody to use in a public or people you meet, any tribe or anybody that wants to learn the language can use that word, thank you. Wherever we go, we say thank you to everybody and everything. So it's a very special word, and tansi means it's a good word too. And how are you? Tansi Mainagina is those words that are very important in our language when we greet somebody or somebody new, or welcoming people in our clanship and all that stuff. So those are very important language to learn, to greet somebody in a special way.
Yeah, because originally, like a long time ago, we wouldn't say hello or we wouldn't say goodbye, right? So English hello, English goodbye is the closest way to define dance, and see you later. We'll get to thank you in a second. But my mother is sharing how important and beautiful the Cree language is, and that I'm pretty sure it's similar in all other language, how English words can't really describe the meaning of your language words, right? So we try to use the closest English words to match up what we're trying to say. Mm-hmm. So in the Cree language, I remember hearing that it was a very beautiful language. It was one of the most beautifulest languages in the world because of the dialect, because of the tongue, and also it's one of the largest languages that you'll see here in Canada. And so we're so excited to teach you these words, and we feel that they are very important to help you learn about our culture, learn about our language, and learn about the Cree background. So like in your language, I'm pretty sure hello and goodbye are said differently than what is really meant for the English language. Does that make any sense? But
one of the important things about language is it comes from your heart, your soul, and your soul understands you and understands what you're saying. But in a white man language as we speak it today, it's our second language, and to me, my language is very important because I speak from my true self. But when I use the white man language, it's kind of
non-indigenous
language. It's a little different. It's not meaningful as my language would be sincerely. So that's how there's a difference between that. So everybody that knows their language, you're lucky to have a language like that because it's most precious gift that you have in yourself is your language.
And yeah. I feel super honored mm-hmm. that I can, you know, that you all can witness me learning mm-hmm. my language with my mother here today. Mm-hmm. And that's a very special gift considering our past history mm-hmm. of indigenous people in this country. So now going back to our word, thank you. In our Cree language, it would be a meaningful goodbye. There's always we'll see you again, right? Right? Okay. There's never like we won't not see you again, right? We never say goodbye in our language, yeah. But it means like okay, farewell, we'll see you again. I don't know, goodbye kind of sounds so harsh.
Okay, goodbye could mean the one that's leaving the world, you know, that's a real goodbye, but yeah. We never say goodbye to anybody in our language. You say, well, see you later then, you know, that's meaningful word for somebody to come back and see you again. So goodbye is not a good word for,
yeah. For so, us. Yeah. So when we say we'll see you again, mm-hmm. We'll see you again, how we say that word is?
Co-op mit non-people.
Yeah.
Gwapmitnankitom, we'll see you again. Yeah.
It's a little bit harder. Gwapmitnankitom.
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 Yeah.
Okay, let's try that again.
Gwapmitnankitom. We'll see you again.
Yeah. And then we have a second farewell greeting, mm-hmm. which is like goodbye, and that is
Egusane.
Yeah, Egusane. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So Egusane, if you want to say it simpler, then it's Egusane.
Egusane.
So that's another form of saying goodbye or mm-hmm. well. Like I said, goodbye kind of sounds harsh mm-hmm. because in our language, it's a softer greeting of parting ways. There, mm-hmm. that's the way to say it. Yeah.
Yeah, those are the good words that we're learning today. And I hope you can share them with your families and all the ones that you want to learn about Cree.
So let's go mm-hmm. over what we went over today. Again, we'll do a quick recap of what we learned. So the first word that we learned was, what was it?
Dance.
Yeah, so we're gonna go over the dialogue of what we learned today, and pardon us, we're just learning. So this is the process of learning how to speak Cree. So I'll start by saying dance.
Mm-hmm. Dance.
Ginamaga.
Monanto.
Oh, ekusane.
Yeah.
We're going to recap the words that we learned today. The first word that we learned today was?
Dance. Dance.
Dance. Now let's say it at home. One, two, three.
Dance.
Good job. So the second word that we learned today was manantau. Manantau. Say it with us at home.
Okay. Yeah.
One, two, three. Manantau.
Manantau.
Good job. So the third word that we learned today was ginamaga, which means
how are you?
Let's try it at home. One, two, three. Ginamaga.
How are you?
Good job. Mm-hmm. So the fourth word that we learned was, it was a little bit harder, so let's try that again. Gitom kawapamatinan. Did I say that right?
Gitom kawapamatinan means we'll see you again.
So let's try that together. One, two, three. Gitom
kawapamatinan. Gitom kawapamatinan. We'll see you again.
And then our final word, which is so appropriate as we're closing up for this wonderful opportunity to come into your living rooms and teach you Cree, is we're saying egusane. So we'll say that together with us. One, two, three.
Egusane.
Egusane. Which means thank you.
Thank you.
So with that being said, we wanted to give you a big thank you for having us, inviting us into your living room and teaching you Cree. We hope you enjoyed it and we can't wait to teach you some more.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tune in every Tuesday at 1 p.m. on 101.5 FM to hear more amazing stories. For more of You Multicultural, visit their website at u-channel.ca for content on diversity and multiculturalism. I'm Ryan Funk. This was U Talk, and have yourself a good one.